Welcome to When Blue Turns Black, a rare and fascinating exploration of true crime. Join former police officer Vonnie T as she reveals intimate details of her career, explores the psychological toll crime can have with others, and shares her own experience with PTSD.
Thank you for joining me for the first episode of When Blue Turns Black. My name is Vonnie T, and my background is a 20-year career as a general duties police officer with the Queensland Police Service. This podcast is a way for me to share stories of jobs that I attended throughout my career and my experiences with post-traumatic stress disorder. Each week, I'll be sharing different stories about different jobs that I attended and the emotional and psychological toll that those jobs took. Just a warning, the content contained within these episodes may be distressing to some listeners. If you or someone you know needs additional support, Lifeline is there to help on 13 11 14. In this episode, I'm going to talk about a job that I went to when I was in Gundawindi. It was the brutal rape and murder of young Gundawindi mum Alexis Jeffrey. Now, before I get into the job, I just want to say that I feel it's relevant for me to talk about this job for two reasons. Firstly, it was my daughter's birthday, so it's a job that will stick with me for the rest of probably my life as I celebrate my daughter's birthday. Every year I think about Alexis on her birthday. Obviously, I think about it at other times, but, you know, not a birthday goes by for my daughter where this doesn't come up for me. And secondly, this would be the job that tipped me over the edge with post-traumatic stress disorder. I continued working on for another probably 13 months after this job, but when I was actually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder by psychiatrists, it turns out that I'd had it for, they think, about 10 years. It originated from when I worked in Brisbane from a job that I went to there, and then it just continued on, and it's called a cumulative effect. So that means that the more exposure to trauma, the more your cup is full, the less likely you are able to deal with stress and those sorts of things. So I just spent the last 10 years prior to that thinking I was just a very highly strung and quite irritable person, or very easily irritated person. I probably was a real pain in the backside to work with and live with at times. But anyway, getting back to the job. So this would be the pivotal job for me. So this is why I really want to talk about it. And probably for one other reason is that it's not just my story, it's Alexis's story. And I know it went through court and it's had its day there, but I feel like it's really also appropriate for me to talk about it because I get to give my side of it partly through her. So this one's for Alexis as well. It was the 16th of March 2014, and Alexis had been, in the early hours of that morning, which was a Sunday, Alexis and her friends had been at one of the pubs in town when it closed. I think from memory they closed at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. It's been a while since I worked there. Anyway, she'd been having a few drinks and having a bit of a party and a dance with her friends, and then when the pub shut, she decided she was going to walk home. Several of her friends had lifts and got in a cab. She decided she wanted to walk home. She was in the company of a male person. I'm not too sure how long she had known this male for, but anyway, they walked through town. They were seen walking through town, and when they were at the town park, they actually had a conversation with police who were patrolling the streets at night. And at this time, police spoke with the two of them, and they didn't feel that there was anything untoward going on between them. They just felt like, they're just a young couple walking on their way home, having a chat and having a bit of fun. And so the police left and continued on the rest of their shift, patrolling and doing the rest of their duty. And they left Alexis in the company of this male person. But unfortunately, she never made it home. Later on that morning at 6 a.m., I commenced shift. I was working a 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. shift, and I was rostered on my own. I was aware that one of the detectives had booked on. We had two detectives at the station. Gundawindi is quite a small station, and at times it sort of operates on skeleton staff. You're going to put more staff on at night time and in the afternoons just to cope with the volume of jobs and the type of jobs that, you know, you're more likely to need two officers to go to, you know, noise complaints or parties and when the pubs are shutting and patrolling the pubs. And during the day, there should be less of those sorts of jobs, so if one officer can work on their own. So anyway, we quite often worked a 6 a.m. shift on the weekends on a Saturday and Sunday on our own. That's nothing too major. So on that morning, I'd been working for a couple of hours. I was at an inquiry on one side of town when I received a call from Toowoomba Comms on the police radio. The information given to me was that there was a possible deceased female on the riverbank, several metres above the waterline, down behind the cultural centre. I was asked to proceed lights and sirens to that job. And so I had to quickly exit the inquiry that I was at and I went to the job location. So the information that Toowoomba Comms had received was from a young gentleman. Him and his mate and his young son were in their boat or in his dinghy. They were travelling up the McIntyre River and they were going to go fishing. So on their way, they saw what they thought was a deceased female. They've called it in, called 000, and they were advised to go back to the boat ramp and wait for police to attend. So I went to the job. En route to the job, being a small country town, I noticed that people were watching where I was going and what I was doing. Not hard to hear the sirens and where it's going as well. So there was people following the police car, but that's pretty normal, just to have a bit of a look at what's going on. I suppose the ambulance officers get the same. So I went off at the job location and then Toowoomba Communications rang the station mobile and I had a conversation with them over the phone. Now, in the time that it took me to get from the inquiry to the actual job location, they spoke at length, at further length with the informant, and that's the male gentleman who is in the boat because he's providing the information. So he's called an informant. And he stated to Toowoomba Comms that he believed that it was just a mannequin. Now, at this stage, I sort of thought, oh, it probably was a bloody mannequin, you know. It's pretty common for, you know, people once they've finished at the pub and they're drunk and they're on their way home to, you know, empty bins or pull plants out of the gardens in town and just do stupid, silly bugger things. And I suppose I thought, well, it's a small country town. It's a great town. I've never been to a murder in this town. I'd been to a murder before and, you know, plenty of deceased persons, but never a murder in the country. So I sort of thought, and well, it is a mannequin and probably, you know, they're just clowning around the night before. But the other thing for me was that I also thought I don't really know anyone in this town who's capable of murdering someone. You know, there's plenty of domestics going on, but I just didn't know anyone that was capable of something like that. So I suppose I thought, yeah, fair enough, it probably is a mannequin. And to think about it now, the informant probably was suffering with shock. Well, he was in shock and that was his brain's way of protecting him from anything that's going to hurt him. So he's rationalized that it's a mannequin, not a deceased person. So anyway, both of us are probably feeling a little bit more desensitized. Well, I know I was. I can't speak for him. He obviously had seen what he had seen and I can't explain that for him. That's his observations and his feelings. Anyway, I had to wait there they were going to call him and let him know to come up the river and to meet me to show me where the body was. His mate was going to stay behind down at the boat ramp at his vehicle with his young son so that they didn't have to go through that traumatic experience again. So anyway, while I was waiting, I walked over. I was behind the cultural centre. It's quite pretty up there. The council look after it and there's, you know, they water the grass and so there's always like the odd kangaroo around and it's quite pretty and there's a picnic table and you can go and sit there and look down at the river. So I sort of walked over towards that picnic table. I suppose I probably should explain that before you get to the picnic table, there's a levee bank that was built along the river to save the township from flooding because it had quite severe flooding in years, like hundred year prior. So there was a levee bank, and on top of that levee bank, there was a concrete path, and a lot of people utilised that as a way to get in and out of town, and even just for exercise. Lots of people ran, walked their dogs, just went for a walk, because rode their bikes. Sometimes it was just a matter of just, you know, riding your bike down to the local, down to the shop to get something, or the supermarket to get a few things, and then ride back. So it was really well utilized, this pathway. And so I've walked across the pathway, I've gone over to the picnic table, and when I've gone across there, I've looked down on the ground and I've seen this really dark patch. But I don't know why, whether I was just desensitized, I just didn't think too much of it. So at that stage, then I've seen the informant coming up, or the young gentleman coming up the river in his dinghy, and I've gone over to where he came in. He's come up the riverbank and had a brief conversation with me. And from there, he sort of said, look, I'll show you where it is, but I'm not going to go over there with you. So he showed me, I found a little track. The riverbank there is quite steep and rocky, lots of long grass, and it can be a bit tricky maneuvering your way through there. Lots of prickles as well. Not too bad, because I had long pants on and boots, so that's okay. So I found a little goat track, walked along, and suddenly it opened up to this little spot where there was Alexis. There was her body. She was laying there half naked. Her legs were spread open. There was blood and ants all over her genital area and all on her torso. And she was laying there lifeless. It gave me a bit of a shock. I was telling myself that it was just going to be a mannequin. It was just going to be some stupid joke. So I've gone over to her. I've looked for any signs of life. Initially, I realized this is going to be a crime scene, so I've got to be really careful what I do here. But I also need to see if she is deceased, or if there's something that I can be doing for her right now. So I looked for any signs of life. I looked to see if her chest was moving. It wasn't. I put my hand down over her mouth. There was no air coming out. There were ants crawling all over her and all over her face. So that sort of indicated that she was deceased. I felt for a pulse and was unable to locate one. So I walked back up the riverbank a little bit, and I called VKR and requested an ambulance to attend immediately. The ambulance was there within no time. It was minutes. It really didn't take long at all. The two officers, I walked them down the riverbank and to where Alexis was, and they did their job and advised me that she was in fact deceased, as I had thought. And I obtained their details and they left the scene. At this stage, I then reported back to VKR, which is Toowoomba Communications. I'm sorry, there's going to be times where I say VKR or Toowoomba Comms. It's the same people. Gundawindi is a small town, and all of our comms for these sorts of jobs go through either Warwick or Toowoomba. At this time, it was Toowoomba because they received the 000 call, and then I stayed in contact with them because all of our specialist staff came from Toowoomba Station. Toowoomba is located about 2.5 to 3 hours away from Gundawindi. And I gave them all the feedback. Anyway, I advised them that it was a crime scene and that she was deceased. I also requested that they get onto CIB. I was also trying to call CIB on my mobile phone. I had the station phone and I was unable to contact them. So I asked VKR to call them because they are the specialists in this area, and I really needed their help. So having said that, then I went into, okay, what have I got to do? I've got to try and preserve evidence at this scene, because if you don't do the right thing in the first place and try to preserve as much evidence, like being the first response officer, that could be the thing that gets someone off, because, you know, the evidence was either contaminated or destroyed in some way. Now, realizing that I had walked through what I thought was now the initial crime scene, which was that blood stain on the ground, it now dawned on me that that was a blood stain. It wasn't just a mark on the ground. I was fully aware that I had contaminated the first crime scene. So I had to, I had to go and stop people from walking in that area. I had to also take the details of the informant, and I took a bit of a brief statement and advised him to go back down to the boat ramp if he could, and we would take up with him soon to get some more information off him. Poor fellow was in shock. Anyway, so having said that, the job just rolled on. There were so many jobs to do, so many things to do, and there was only one person. I called my boss. He's the one that makes all the decisions. He has all the know-how, and he, you know, he knows what to do. I couldn't get onto him at first. He was busy with a personal job at the time. So then I went into the next mode of thinking, well, who worked last night? Because they're going to come back in for duty this afternoon anyway. So I just started, I went through the list of who I knew had worked because I'd seen the job logs. And I started ringing them one by one and saying, you're going to have to come back in, just go to the station. I'm sure by the time you get there, boss will be in and he'll have this all sorted. So at that stage, I'm running around like a chook with no head. And I'm also trying to preserve this scene. So after a while, more police turned up and that was good. Unfortunately, there was also a lot of onlookers because they'd heard me going to the job. Some people had had scanners, so they knew that police were down there. There were, as more police turned up and we cordoned off the area, obviously people were like, oh, what's going on? What's going on? So we had a job to keep people away as well. And the boss had started a forward command post. So that was really good. So that's where all the hierarchies are in there and the detectives are in there, and they then advise on what jobs need to be done and what part of the evidence gathering stage it was at. So I was, I've been pretty busy. I hadn't had anything to eat. It was a really hot day, and I was a little bit emotional. I was just trying to keep busy as well because I didn't want to think about poor Alexis sitting down there, laying down there on the bank on her own. And I'd gone back up to the forward command post, and I was just waiting further direction. And I had several members of the public coming up and talking to me, and they were saying, one person in particular, he was a security officer, and he had been working at that pub the night before doing his role of security. And he knows Alexis quite well. And he came up to me, he was very distressed, and he said to me, I know that that's Alexis down there. I know that there's a deceased female down there. Now, she's the only person that we know of who hasn't contacted anyone, hasn't been in any contact, and we are unable to contact her. And then he broke down and he said, I offered her a lift last night. He said, there were some guys hanging off her and they were trouble. And he said, if only I had have just made a get in the car, I would have just driven her home. And he said, this is all my fault. This is all my fault. So anyway, this poor fellow, I let him go on for a little bit. And then I said, look, we haven't identified who it is down there. There is a deceased female. There's processes that have to be followed. And when they have and we are able to formally identify the person, we will let her family know and then members of the public will know. I said, it's best that you go home and you stay by your phone and, you know, you just need to calm down and you need to stop guilting yourself. So I had several people come up at that time talking to me. It was pretty draining, actually. And that's the role of a police officer, though. That's what police do. But it was very draining and it was very hard to deal with because I had seen her. And then to listen to their guilt, it was a little bit overwhelming. So anyway, not long after that, I was there with several other officers and the boss came out and said, look, I need two officers to go down and secure the scene, secure the crime scene. He said, we need to put a tarp up over the deceased. We're not sure if there's going to be a storm coming. Scenes of crime and, you know, all the other specialists like homicide detectives and that would not be arriving until later on in the afternoon. Just due to logistics, you know, Gundawindi's a long way away from anywhere. And he said, we need to preserve the scene just in case we get a storm and just from the elements of the sun because it is quite a hot day. So I looked at another police officer, one of my mates, he was standing there and he said, I'll go. And I said, well, you haven't been down there. And I said, to be honest, I'll go, boss. I said to him, I just said, I feel responsible for her because she's down there on her own and she's really vulnerable. And if that was me, I would hope that any female officer that arrived or was on scene would preserve my dignity, would do everything that they could to preserve my dignity. Because I felt like putting a sheet over her. I felt like covering her up. But you can't do that because there might be some little bit of evidence there that I may be contaminating. So, yeah, I get a bit emotional when I talk about this. So I put my hand up and I said to the other officer, I said, no disrespect to you. I know you're strong and I know you're a good guy. But the thing is it's quite confronting and I don't want you to have to see her either. Because, you know, I'd already been down there with her. So the decision was made. Myself and one of the other detectives went down. We went with SES in a boat along the river. And we had a tarp and some tent pegs and that sort of stuff. And I got in the water and I was holding one corner of the tarp while I was in the water. I was about, the water was like over my chest. It was up to my chest. So, you know, I'd taken my kit off and left that and got in. And where I was standing, because I had to sort of anchor the tarp from one corner while the detective and one of the other SES fellas was up on the riverbank up higher, putting in the tent pegs and attaching the tarp to it. It was really steep at that section and it was quite rocky, a lot of grass, a lot of prickles, and it was not an easy job to do. So I went in the water. I'm quite strong for a little girl, so I could hold the tarp up and I held it up for quite a while. But while I was there, I noticed, like as I looked, it's like the elephant in the room. I couldn't help but look. I turned to Alexis and I looked at her and my face was right in line with her face. And initially when I attended the job, you know, I had so many things going through my mind. Preserving the evidence was second on my list. Firstly on my list was checking to see if she was actually alive or not and, you know, the first aid. But in that time that I was in the water and I was standing there and I looked at her face and then I looked at her hair and I could see all the prickles in her hair and her hair was all matted. And then I could really see and feel the trauma that she went through in those last moments of her life. I could see the horror that she must have gone through. And I just wished that it didn't happen. I wished that it hadn't happened to her. I didn't know the woman, but I know that nobody deserves to have their life ended in that manner. And I could just see that it was horrific. It was brutal. And I can't imagine what she went through. And it was at that point that I knew that this job would stick with me, that I was attached to this job emotionally, whether I liked it or not. And, you know, I know people might say that, oh, well, you're a police officer, you should be immune to this sort of thing, but you're not. I'm a human being as well. I'm a woman. Like her, I'm a mother. I knew that she had young children at home waiting for her. I myself had a young child at home waiting for me. And whether I liked it or not, I had put myself in her situation and my heart sank and I just can't imagine what she went through. And I just don't believe that she deserved it or that any human being deserves to be treated like that. That was a real eye-opener for me. Maybe if I hadn't have gone back down, I wouldn't have seen that and maybe it wouldn't have stuck with me as much. But unfortunately, it was the right thing to do. I was the only female police officer stationed at Gundawindi at that time. I was rostered on shift. I was a reporting officer. I had already seen her. So it was the right thing for me to do, to go down there as a woman and preserve her dignity the best that I possibly could. That was me. I just wouldn't have wanted so many men around. I mean, I know that's the nature of the job and that's the way it is, but, you know, us girls, we sort of, you got to do the right thing by each other, especially in a time like that. Anyway, after that job, after we got the tarp up, we clambered back up the riverbank. I got my kit back and I was covered in mud and dirt, a whole police uniform. It was just a mess. And I went back up to see the boss. One thing that sticks in my mind is when I got back up there, there was a very senior officer from Toowoomba who had turned up, and he looked at myself and the other detective, and we were both muddied and wet, and he just looked down his nose at the pair of us. And I was disgusted that he couldn't see what we had just been through and that we had just done the right thing. Anyway, not everyone's going to feel like that. The detective was going to give me a lift home. I was going to have a shower and get a change of clothes, grab those boots because I'd have to take the boots back into the station and leave them there for the scenes of crime officer to get my boot imprint. And anyway, so, yeah, the thing was to have a quick shower, get changed into some decent clothes so I could go back to the station and take some statements. So when I arrived home, my daughter, who was now four, she was very excited to see me, even though I was covered in mud and I was all wet. And she just wanted me to stay home with her. She just wanted me to cuddle and snuggle with her and, you know, have a bit of fun. But unfortunately, that wasn't to be. And she got very upset when I had to leave because I'd only been home a short while, maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. And I was exhausted. I didn't really want to go back to work, but that's the way it is. That's the job. You don't get the chance to choose. When something happens, you've just got to go and do it. So I had to say my goodbyes to her. She was crying and sad, and it sort of broke my heart a little bit that I had to leave her because it was her special day. But I sort of said to her, it's just the way it is, Bubby. Mummy has to go and be a police officer today. Don't really know why I said that, because I don't really expect a four-year-old to understand that Mummy can't be there with her because she has to go and be a police officer. Anyway, so the detective picked me up and we went back to the station. And for the next couple of hours, I took several statements from three witnesses. And these statements were all people who were the last to see her, or people who had had a conversation with her the night before, or people who had received like text messages or had tried to contact her. And it was pretty much just trying to get a bit of a timeline for what had gone on with Alexis and who had spoken to her. And just to see if she'd said anything about where she was or who she was with and what was going on. So, again, I found this really hard. These people were all feeling very guilty. They were also in shock that Alexis had died, and not just that she had died, but she had been murdered. They didn't feel like I suppose anyone, they didn't feel that she deserved what happened to her. And they were in shock, but they were also grieving. So, and you know, they were really hard on themselves, which I suppose we all do when we get this initial sort of news. And it would be very hard to provide a statement to police. But at this stage, you know, after everything that had gone on for the day, I think I became too emotionally attached to it, and I was taking on the emotions of everyone at this stage. So I did try to do the best job that I could. I suppose I also knew that these statements could be like fixed up at a later stage if there was information that I'd missed or anything like that. It was just to mainly get something down at that point in time. Obviously I try to do my best, but you know, sometimes, well, we're all human. We can make mistakes or, you know, possibly be too emotional and then forget to ask some other question and put that in the statement that is quite relevant. Anyway, once this was finished, I went home, and that was it for the rest of the shift for me. It was dark. I'd been at work all day, hadn't eaten much. Not that I'm complaining. That's the way the job is. But yeah, I was completely exhausted, and I was emotionally exhausted. Didn't really know what to do or what to be at that stage. I didn't know how to think about it. I just sort of pretty well felt numb. As far as the investigation goes, I had no further part in it. I was the reporting officer at, you know, first on scene, but that was it. I didn't do any of the investigating. I'm not qualified to be an investigator. And yeah, so it wasn't a job that I I had any further with, except I provided a statement later throughout the process to say pretty much everything I've said to you guys today, but in a lot more detail, and that was for court. I will go on to say that, well, in the investigation side of things, detectives came down from Toowoomba and Brisbane, and they were on like a rotational shift, and they ended up with an outcome. A male person was charged and convicted of her brutal rape and murder, and he's now serving a custodial sentence. So everything that was done on the day was done right, and obviously everything that they did throughout their investigation was done right as well. So that's a really good result for Alexis and her family. There was one other thing that I wanted to talk about as well with this one, and this is why I had a deep connection with this job and I wanted to talk about it, was as I mentioned at the start, I ended up with a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder about 13 months after this job. I knew that things weren't quite so good for me after this job. I sort of went downhill. Anyway, we'll talk about that in other episodes. But I was at a stage where I was off work. I'd had pretty much like a mental and physical breakdown, and that's what I thought was going on with me. I thought I've hit 40. Maybe I just don't know how I'm dealing with that. I'd heard about midlife crisis, but anyway, it turned out to be post-traumatic stress disorder. So while I was off work and I was going through the initial stages of the diagnosis and work cover and all that sort of thing, I was in a pretty dark place. Again, like I said, I wasn't working. I was spending my time at home. I was severely depressed. There were other things going on in my personal life that weren't so good. Pretty much it fell apart. And I was, very anxious, severely depressed. I was actually suicidal at that point in time. I was just trying to keep a brave face on in front of other people. And I was concentrating on just trying to be mum and getting my daughter to and from school. And that was pretty much it at that point. I was trialing all different medications. Some made me feel more suicidal than others. Anyway, I've always been a bit of a spiritual person, and I'd been told about this lady in town who does readings, psychic readings, and she was quite good. So I thought, I might just book in. I'm just going to go and see this lady because I'm at the end of my tether. I need a sign. I need something. I was feeling quite desperate for a sign that things were going to change, that I wasn't going to be stuck in this hole forever because I really didn't know how I was going to get out of it. So I went to the psychic reading. I sort of thought I'll keep an open mind and hopefully I'll get some good news. Hopefully there's going to be something. There's going to be something to give me that little glimmer of hope. So I went. The reading was good. The lady talked about other things that I had going on in my life, which, made a lot of sense to me at the time. And at the end, she was clearing the energy in the room. You know how they hit the bell on the, I don't know what you call it, but they make a bell sound to clear all negative and or any energy in the room. And when she did this, she'd hit it several times and she said, look, I can't finish this. And I said, why? And she said, there's a lady who's been here right from the start. She said, she is bugging me. She's really bugging me to give you a message. She said, I didn't ignore her, but I put it to the side because there were other people here who have recently passed and really needed me to connect with you. So she said, I was just going to leave it be, but she said she's refusing to go and she's like badgering me to talk to you. I said, okay, well, if that's okay with you. She said, no, it's fine. And then she said, she described the lady that was standing there and it was Alexis. I knew straight away it was Alexis. And I sort of thought, well, this lady lives near the job location. Possibly she saw me attend on the day. I'm the only female officer in town. So, maybe she was just having a bit of a stab in the dark. So we'll just see what she's got to say. And then she went really quiet. And then she said to me, she wants me to tell you this. She wants me to thank you for treating her with dignity on that day. Oh, now I get really emotional when I think about this because there's no way that that lady or anyone else would know that. I only said to one other person, and that was that male officer that I was working with, my mate, who now doesn't work in Gundwindi. I said to him on that day, I don't want you to go back down there.
because I'm the only female here and I want to preserve her dignity. I want to do the best thing I possibly can for her. I never breathed a word of that to anyone else. So I knew on that day, at that reading, at that moment, that it was Alexis. And I lost it. I cried. And I feel like crying now when I talk about it. But it's made this whole journey for me worth it. Everything I went through, the downfall with the PTSD, my broken relationships, my failed friendships, losing my career, everything was worth it because I know that on that day, I did the right thing. It was to my detriment to go back down there, but it was to preserve her dignity. And that means the world to me. Most likely I was going to end up in a heap anyway, because the post-traumatic stress disorder was just, it was there. I just didn't know that it was there. So it was always going to happen, but I'm really proud of myself that I did the right thing, because that's my life's motto, to do the right thing by other people. And I'm really glad that I was able to connect on that day, and that it was real, and that everything that I had felt was true. So, yeah, that's where this job ends for me. There's not much more I can say about it, actually. Yeah, I just hope that other officers out there are doing the right thing for themselves, and if they feel that they're emotionally attached at any stage to a job that's, you know, starting to take them over, I hope that they ask for help, because that's something that police officers are really terrible at. We all put on that brave face, you know, the word around the station is take a teaspoon of cement and harden up. But, you know, that's not going to get you anywhere. That's just going to get you in a heap. And when you fall in a heap, who's going to be there to help you? So, I just hope that that's one thing that other officers who may listen to this podcast can get out of this, and that anyone who's feeling overwhelmed at any stage by stress, anxiety, by an emotional attachment to something, that you please put your hand up and ask for help.
Thank you for listening to When Blue Turns Black. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review, which helps others find the podcast, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on Vonnie and her journey, visit VonnieT-TheResilientWoman.com.